Morning, everybody.
Morning.
I'd like to extend a special thanks to Owen and Rob and Sosan because my car wouldn't start today. And they are the ones that got me here. So I'm really glad that I could be in person with some portion of the Sangha. It's just really, it fills my heart with joy. I'd also like to start by dedicating this talk to those who were driven off this land in the month of December, 1860s, I don't have the exact year, but those are our indigenous relatives. And one of the indigenous,
you have to wave to the camera.
Yeah, I have to wave. I was just going to say, oh. But let me come back to the feeling in my heart right now for the terrible, terrible, terrible history of the indigenous people in the time that they've been interacting with those of us who are not indigenous. And one of our indigenous relatives, a Dakota grandmother, and a longtime carrier of the traditions, and very active in educating other members of her tribe and peoples in some of the rituals and religion and practices of the indigenous peoples. Her name is Darlene Renville Pipeboy. She died in the beginning of December. She was affectionately known by her family as Yoda. And I had a chance to meet her and spend some time and learn from her. So I very much dedicate this talk to her in particular, but to all our Indigenous relatives, all those who have made it possible for us to be here. So last night, we had a full moon. And it was the longest full moon night of the year. And tonight, we're going to be holding, I think tonight, we're going to be holding a full moon precept ceremony. When we will, in the words of Dogen Zenji, reveal and disclose our lack of faith and practice before the Buddhas. Let me see if I have. There is a vow that we sometimes chant, but which I chanted for much of my early practice, that ends with this paragraph: revealing and disclosing one's lack of faith and practice before the Buddhas, the power of this revelation melts away the root of transgressions. This is the pure and simple color of true practice, of the true mind of faith and the true body of faith. So the precepts are near and dear to my heart, and I'll say a little bit more about that later. So it's also going to be the winter solstice on Tuesday, December 21st, for one moment, at 10:59 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. I guess that would be 9:59 a.m. Central Standard Time in the Northern Hemisphere. It is the time of the shortest day and the longest night in this particular location. In the next moment, we begin to experience the beginning of the lengthening of days until the vernal or spring equinox happens at 11:33 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, or 10:33 Eastern or Central Daylight Time. And the days begin to shorten. And we are also just a little ways away from the end of 2021 on December 31st, which is a Friday. Traditionally, for many, the end of the year is a time of reflecting on the past, forgiving, and beginning anew. So that's the mindset that's in my heart and mind as I speak right now. And I want to just reflect out loud a little bit. First of all, and as ever, I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature of change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. My deeds are my closest companions. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. So as I read that out and consider those, I don't know whether I can call all of them truths, but anyway, when I consider what I've just reflected on, a couple of things come up for me. By the way, can you guys hear me? Okay, good. How we construct time. How pervasive is anger, hatred, and fury? That we are all connected always. That was something that every time and repeatedly during my visits with Darlene, she would say, we are all connected. We are all connected. What a strong protection the precepts provide, and how easy it is to neglect them. How terribly important our choices and actions are. So about time, it struck me as I was looking up these little facts about solstice and full moons, that these are things that we have lots of activities around, and yet they're just a temporary, sometimes inadequate way of trying to grapple with something that doesn't exist, which is time. It's like, well, we don't know what else to call it. We have to deal with it in some way. So it helped me remember that my ideas of the universe are not what the universe is, or that even the name universe is misleading in its own way. The impact of our actions is not time-bounded, really. That means our choices. billions a day are not only personal. They are not all about us. Every action has an effect, and every effect leads to a cause in an infinite web of life. We can never take an action that does not affect everyone, including ourselves. We are all connected. How pervasive is anger, hatred, and fury? That's really been coming up for me strongly. Part of the work I'm doing with myself to unbound me from my ideas of myself and other people is reading a lot of history. And there's a lot of it available. A lot of it's available in movies as well as in books. And what really came to me was our history, really back as far as we can go as human beings, is so harmful.
Kyoku?
Yeah.
People on Zoom are having a hard time hearing you.
Okay.
So either you need to speak louder or maybe take off your mask if you're comfortable with that. Or both.
Yeah, is anybody uncomfortable with
me? I can make
you?
One more suggestion.
Okay.
Could you move the microphone to the center as opposed to the left? So that you can make that specifically. See if that helps.
Thank you. Does anybody have an objection to me removing my mask? Temporarily? Okay. All right, so let me return to this topic of pervasive anger. So, in doing some of my own work and then just reading the newspapers and being more mindful of my own actions in every moment and more aware of things that arise as I notice just how I'm interacting with people and just what ideas are in my mind. But particularly when I reflect on how long we've been collectively repressing, torturing, ignoring, feeling superior to, making life incredibly difficult and painful for people of color. And when I let that really sink in, the first thing that comes up is this is unforgivable. I have not very often in my own life become really furious. But one or two times, well, actually one very significant time, I was very present to my own fury. And I realized, really, there is no remedy for what I feel is unforgivable. It's like if the person I'm furious with would die, that still doesn't take care of the fury. That's how distorting it is. That's how strong it is. So, what do we do about the unforgivable? How do we respond appropriately to the unforgivable? We had a person of color come to a retreat at Hokioji Zen Practice Center, which I neglected to include in my biography for anybody who doesn't know that already. It's down there, pretty close to the Mississippi, and you have to drive into Iowa before the road comes back into Minnesota. So it's pretty far southeast. I just lost my train of thought.
A person of color had come to Hokioji. A person of color had come to Hokioji.
So I came to a retreat, and I was at the end of the retreat talking to people, and he mentioned that he was very glad to arrive because he was very leery of what might come up as he traveled for 3 hours between the Twin Cities and Hokioji. That's a very deep harm. What could possibly make amends for that? So I think we all wrangle with that in one way or another. So I turned to our practice. And the Buddha said, hatred by hatred never ceases. But by love alone is healed. Now, we know some people like Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Buddha, Viktor Frankl. There are people who have known this in a deep, deep way in themselves and set for us all the example of their lives and their teachings about how we can respond even where there's hatred without hatred. Because when you think about it, I mean, when I thought about it, I thought, well, if it is unforgivable and cannot possibly be repaired or undone, then that means we're stuck there. There's really no way to respond then. I'm just stuck with unforgivable. So that's when the Buddhist teachings help us. I was reading in preparation for this talk and in response to my own reflections, the Nonviolent Communication book that was written by Mr. Rosenberg, who's now dead. It's a class I've taken. It's a practice I try to talk about. But in the beginning of that book is a wonderful reflection by Gandhi's grandson. And in it, he talks about growing up in South Africa, where he was bullied and discriminated against in very painful ways. And as a young teen, his parents decided to send him to spend some time with his grandfather because he was so angry and so unhappy. And the first thing that his grandfather did was to say, first, we have to look at our own violence because we are all violent. And so he set him for 3 or more months to the task of each day coming home from having spent the day and taking his experiences and classifying them, kind of tracing their impacts, tracing the experience, but classifying them as physical violence or passive violence. And his grandson found that there was far more passive violence, and passive violence, to clarify, is, where do I have it here? That's where the hurt is more emotional, as opposed to physical violence. And what his grandfather pointed out to him is that passive violence is more insidious because it generates anger in the victim and fuels physical violence. So he seemed to be saying, really, it starts passively. It can be expressed physically, but it is a cause. Going back to, we cannot take any action that doesn't affect everybody. And so it gives birth. It's a cause then for physical violence. And he posed, his grandfather posed the question, how can we extinguish a fire if we don't first cut off the fuel that ignites the inferno? So basically, if we're all mad for one reason or another, how do we ever get to love? Well, one thing that I reflect on is, first, how do I feel when I get mad at how somebody's treating me? And what do I know about my idea of me and how representative that is of what's really happening in full in the world? What do I know about situations where I've made assumptions which have given rise to my anger? And I didn't even know they were assumptions. I thought they were reality. And sometimes, in working with that kind of anger, even before I practiced Buddhism, I thought, how am I going to get rid of this anger? It's so uncomfortable. And it's not doing any good to just be angry. It's just so unsatisfying. So that's when I started trying to see, well, where might I be misseeing what's really happening for that person? And sometimes, if I feel a harm had been done to me and I was feeling resentful and I couldn't really get rid of my anger, it just kept rising up like a sore in the heart. And I would sit down with the person I was angry at, and usually unskillfully say, I'm really angry at you for doing that. You're really a bad person. And I'd like to, I want you to know about that. And I want to understand why you did these things. And almost always, I found out that I didn't have quite the whole story. When I could sit still enough for long enough just to hear what was going on for that other person, probably most of us have had some kind of an experience where we've gotten angry or we've reacted negatively, and then all of a sudden one fact changed. One fact changed, and it completely changed our point of view. So I've learned that when I'm really angry, I'm definitely not seeing straight. And that's where the love can come in. That's where the opening for, at the very least, considering what the other person is going through might be about. Not with the mind and the object of judging, which just arises naturally. Not from the almost always position of not meeting that person on equal ground, but meeting them thinking, I am right, I am superior. It's not always something I can hear out loud. But when I look carefully, something like that is always there. And I found out that it works even with like flies and whether I'm going to kill them or not when they bug me. It makes me realize how pervasive violence is, or passive violence is. All the thoughts. I'm sure you've heard this one verse from the Dhammapada that is credited to the Buddha. The thought manifests as word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit, and the habit into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care. And let it spring from love, born out of concern for all beings. As the shadow follows the body, as we think, so we become. And that takes me to the Metta Sutta. I have that with me. It's such a wonderful sutta. This is a somewhat different version than we use here. To reach the state of peace, one skilled in the good should be capable and upright, easy to speak to and straightforward, of gentle nature and not proud, contented and easily supported. Isn't that nice? Contented and easily supported. Living lightly and having few duties, wise and with senses calmed, not arrogant and without greed for supporters, and should not do the least thing that the wise would reproach them for. One should reflect in this way, may all beings be happy and secure. May all beings be happy-minded. I'm not going to read this whole sutra, but I recommend it for reading every day or chanting every day. It is a powerful reminder. It's a powerful transformer of how we can choose to live. So likes and dislikes we learn in Buddhism are naturally arising, but our response to that uncontrollable feeling that arises, oh, there's two flies in the kitchen and they keep bugging me, unpleasant. So unpleasant is just happens. The response doesn't. It's a choice. So the Metta Sutta is a choice. We need to choose in the billions of moments in each day how to respond instead of just react. So that's where the choice gets made. It's in tiny one moment waves. Just like a sea cave in the Apostle Islands is formed one wave at a time. You can see the one that you're in contains a continuing process of the caves that are beginning, how the rock is eroded away. So Thich Nhat Hanh talks to us about habits, our bad habits, and embracing them, because they are the very way that we practice the Four Noble Truths. By embracing them and looking at them, first of all, see the suffering. We penetrate the truth of suffering, how really tiny, tiny moments we have choice. And we have a choice to let the moment of anger pass, the moment of unpleasant pass, and to return to a sense of responsibility for all that's happening. Because whatever we do, responsibly or irresponsibly, will affect the entire universe. So reflecting on the precepts, which were really the core of what we need to do to fulfill the second noble truth, is to abandon those things that lead to suffering and cultivate those things that lead to non-suffering. And to do that, the Buddha said, we have to know them intimately. We can't just know them in our head. We have to have an experience of the joys, the pleasures, the great love that seems like it's everything, except it has so many strings attached. I once heard Dan Tigan Leighton speak, and he said, you know, we take the vow to free all beings. He said, so, who do you think we should start with? And there was kind of silence, you know, people were like, when you put it that way. And then he said, well, how about our families? And there was this general outcry. No, not families. Those are the hardest. But when we ask ourselves the question, what's the most important thing? How many of us answer, my loved ones, my family, my friends, the people I am intimate with? We're just not all that easy to get along with. And yet, I do find that when I just ask myself the question, can you relate in even a tiny way to the suffering of this person? I have had an active practice for that with my feelings about our former president, Mr. Trump. And it really helps for me to at least be able to be have at least a kind wish that he could be happy. And I figure even when it's really hard to do that, or it's not a very energetic, heartfelt wish, that it starts the energy going, and it softens me. I can feel the softening in my body, in my mind. He's just another human being that wants to live according to how he sees the world, which is just as flawed as the way I see the world. It's nice to have company when you're miserable. So, the other thing that's really important to understand about the precepts, at least for me, is recognizing that actually, while I have a passionate desire to be enlightened, which I used to think meant no more problems, which it turns out is not the case. We still have pain. We still have the five remembrances. But without following the precepts, we can't possibly realize the path of the cessation of suffering. So this thing that I passionately want is made impossible by the things I passionately object to. So that makes me, as I said, it makes me realize how strong the protection of the precepts is. Charlotte Joko Beck warns that the precepts can be dangerous if we see them as commandments, and I've often thought of them in that way, but they're really much more dynamic than a commandment. They're not rules. We have to really interact with them, even though they are, perhaps we have understood them as commandments in other spiritual practices and believe in them as rules. They can function as rules, but if they're not a part of our dynamic life, then they're just another part of a me that doesn't exist, being a good person or some other thing that we have an idea about with this me. It's 10:15. I'll speed this up. So practicing the precepts is about choice and really, really taking responsibility, really deeply taking responsibility for the fact that all of our choices, and we have them, A, can be made as opposed to just sticking with the actions, and B, will not only affect everybody in that moment, but because time is really something that we make up, it's part of our past and our future forever. That responsibility, we only have a chance to implement one moment at a time. And there's billions of them. I mean, gazillions. I don't think we have a name for the amount of those moments. And they can only, That's the only time we have to make the choice. So practicing the precepts is about choice, taking responsibility, and being awake to the motivation and consequences of our actions. Passive, tiny, or obvious and big. It's a choice to engage in our lives with intelligence or ignorance. I would say the vast portion of my day has to do with reacting and trying to ignore things that I don't like. So this is a much more vital and present way of living our lives. And as Dokai Georgeson, our head teacher at Hokioji, once said to me, he said, "You can't change just because you want to." It really set me back on my heels. It was like, what do you mean? But the more I reflected on it, it was like, yeah, that's right. I have a lot of bad habits, you know, according to the Buddhist psychology. We have these bad habits, and as Thich Nhat Hanh says, it takes a lot of work to retrain a habit. So we have two basic areas of work: developing, cultivating good habits, and reversing, weakening, and eventually undoing bad habits. So we have to do the work. We have to really do that work if I want to create the opportunity for forgiveness, for fully alive, present, compassionate, wise living. I can only do it one moment at a time, when I'm awake and when I choose to respond in a way to support that outcome. And undaunted by the mistakes that I'll make in the process of learning how to do that, the harm that I'll do in the process of doing that. I guess the other thing that I reflect on is that the Buddha said very clearly, the Buddhist teaching will not last forever either. There will come a time when it is no longer, that it is completely unknown. So I would like in my lifetime to contribute to it continuing. It's 10:20. I want to just say the metta practice is something that the Buddha asked his monks to do every day. And he asked them every day to spend an amount of time radiating loving kindness. So here are some phrases from my own metta practice that I borrowed, I think, from a lot of other people's metta practice. I'm cold, so I'm shivering here a little bit.
Turn the fan off.
The fan?
We turned it off so we could hear you.
Oh, okay. So here are some that I use a lot in my daily practice. May the power of loving kindness sustain us all. May I forgive myself, mistakes made, and things left undone. May I find the resources to be present for my own and other suffering. So the ruler of the universe, the Eno over here, is going to tell me whether we have any time for people to make comments or ask questions.
I have one. During Rohatsu, you mentioned, you gave an example of the precepts in hell, it's a choice. And you gave an example of like not killing, to take the path of not killing. And things are not cut and try in life, you know, you have, there are things in there. And so you gave an example of this situation and how the choice is made. It's not just, I don't kill, or whatever that means. There's just a lot of choices within that. It's not cut and dry. I just wonder if you could talk about that just a little bit.
Okay, are you talking about the fly?
I think so, yeah.
So while I was writing the talk that that example was in, a fly landed on my page, and my reaction was, whoa! It was a big fly. It was a slow fly, too. It just kind of went blah. And I went through this process of, and then, ooh, get it, you know, get it away from me. And then it was like, take up the way. I take up the way of not killing. So that kind of stopped me. And I'm like, sort of sighing. I hate it when this happens. It's like, what am I going to do? So then this idea came to me, and I was like, oh, maybe I could put it outside. So I folded the paper, and I sealed it up. And then, you know, it was kind of a challenge because I couldn't open the door while I was holding the fly in the paper, but I managed to do it. And then I just kind of threw it outside. And the fly came. It just wants to be me. And so I said, may I let go? And what I said was something that Tomoe Katagiri said to me, and that I included in another talk, which was, everything is tiny. This is a tiny unfolding of, I don't know how many, but a lot of moments that were packed in, where there was waiting in there and all that kind of good stuff. And it's also, I guess, an example of how when you practice the precepts, they're there. They're there, they're on guard. You have to brush up against them. So I encourage you all to consider taking the precept class. It's being offered for Jukai later this year. But also, it's a great ceremony that we take twice a month. But it's also a great practice to just say the precepts, because it really strengthens them. Now it's time.
Now it's time. Thank you, Kyoko. Mm-hmm.